Hello and welcome to our fourth episode of the Raw Denim Podcast. We're still here. I am the managing editor of Raw Denim, Mr. David Shuck, and I'm here to take you on an audio journey of all things indigo and faded. Today we have a very special guest for you. You might know him as the founder of the RGT fam, or as Carl Thonason, the founder of Rogue Territory, a denim and lifestyle brand based in Los Angeles, California. We sat down with Carl to talk about everything from his first interest in denim to his learning how to sew to his days working and making custom jeans at LA's American Rag, all the way through what it took to found Rogue Territory. So if you are a fan of Rogue Territory at all or just want to hear some great stories about how to start up your own jean brand in LA, stick around. Carl's got some great stories for us. This episode of the Raw Denim Podcast is brought to you by North American Quality Purveyors. Their mission is as clear as their name. North American Quality Purveyors brings together Canadian and American-made men's apparel and accessories from brands devoted to creating quality, crafted products that will stand the test of time. Both online and in their store in Calgary, NAQP carries a curated selection of the best North American products from Railcar Fine Goods, Gitman Brothers Vintage, Left Field NYC, New England Outerwear, Victory, Tellison, DN1920, and of course, Rogue Territory. NAQP is offering podcast listeners 15% off their order with the discount code RAR15. That's RAWR15 for 15% off all regularly priced items. Buy quality, buy North American Quality Purveyors. I'm here in Glendale, California with Carl Thonason of Rogue Territory. Oh, thanks so much for coming on, Carl.
No problem.
Yeah, thanks for having us. It's the move-out days here in the old RGT headquarters. It's been a couple years since I've been back here, and things have stacked up quite a bit. It looks like you guys are ready to move out into greener pastures, so like larger areas here soon.
Yeah, we're excited to to kind of grow into a bigger space and just have a little bit more room to stretch out.
Yeah.
Over the last 2 years, it's been crucial to have our setup here, like right in our backyard. It's been awesome to be able to walk out in the morning to go to work and just stay long hours and come in whenever you need to. So
yeah,
it was definitely, this house took care of us for sure.
A lot of big companies have started out of garages, and kind of a milestone here for
it is definitely a milestone. I don't want to compare myself to others.
Like Apple, but, GM.
All right, well, we're almost there. Yeah. But before this, we moved just a block away, and we were actually in a single car garage.
So oh, wow.
We went from a single car garage to a two car garage, and now to an office.
So. An office. It's the American dream there. Well, your new spot's downtown.
It is.
Yeah. Cool. Downtown has changed quite a bit. You wouldn't be put in an office like this in downtown like 5 years ago or something, would
probably
you?
Probably not. I mean, I've been downtown for about 5 years, and it's changed a lot. And I wouldn't even say that I'm a pioneer at all as far as, you know, working downtown and being downtown. But it's exciting. It's an exciting place to be. I actually just with moving into this new spot, didn't realize how many people in the fashion industry worked down around there. I was very surprised.
The fashion district is becoming the fashion district again.
It is, but unfortunately, with that growth, a lot of the manufacturers and family-owned businesses are getting pushed out.
Yeah.
So
it's a balance there.
It is a balance, and unfortunately, they're getting a little bit more space, a little bit further outside of downtown, but it's just kind of, change is hard sometimes. So some people can handle it and some can't. So it's been interesting over the last few years to see how that has been going.
As I was here in like 2010 and I had an internship in Santa Monica, and just everyone there was saying like, just don't go downtown. Just, like, you know, get on the freeways. Don't take any exits there. You'll be okay.
That's because they live on the west side.
Yeah, they live on the west side, and they're all terrified. And then, you know, when I moved out here in, I guess, 2012 and was living in, like, Los Feliz, Thai Town area, I was like, oh, this is, downtown's actually really cool. I can take the train down there. Like, don't have to worry about parking. There's, like, Grand Central Market. It's awesome. And it seems like a lot of other people are sort of taking notice there, and it still at the moment has some of its old character, but you just hope it doesn't, you know, hope it doesn't move out too quickly.
Yeah, I constantly am hearing people talking about how they're trying to find a balance between bringing new stores, new shops, new businesses in, but maintaining that same feel that's been very strong there with the Latin culture and Broadway being the way it is. But reviving it to a certain extent. But, I mean, a downtown that doesn't feel a little gritty is not a downtown I would really want to be a part of. I remember driving into San Diego, which is a beautiful city which I lived in for 2.5 years. But that downtown area, I thought it was a movie set. I was like, whoa, this place is way too clean. Like, there's too much new stuff here. I felt a little uncomfortable. So I really love, like, being able to drive downtown and be a part of that hustle and bustle, and there's just so many different things going on that it's been fun.
Oh. When is the move-in day?
We're moved in officially.
You're done?
Yeah. So
congratulations.
We got the keys, thank you. The only thing there right now is a rolling rack with our fall winter samples. And a chair. There's a chair.
Yeah, you gotta have a chair.
Yeah. So I've had a few meetings over the past week there, just because people have been in town for inspiration. But the official, I think we'll probably start bagging everything up here at the end of this month, the 26th or something, to do it.
Yeah. A lot of jeans in this house at the moment. There is.
Yeah, it's I mean, we.
How many pairs do you think, or, like, how many individual items do you think in this garage and in the house? Because just in to use the bathroom, and there's, like, dozens and dozens and dozens of bags, like, wax supply jackets and, like, jumper shirts, and it's crazy. It's
well,
like
a
rogue territory buffet. Yeah.
This is a busy time of year for us. This is when we're
spring, summer's
all
going
our
out.
Spring-summer production, so, like I was telling you, normally we rent a container and put it on our front driveway and fill that up, which was never super convenient, but it was what we could do. You know, since we're kind of between the office and our house, we decided to fill that up, and it kind of comes and goes pretty quickly. The next few weeks are going to be pretty busy, but it's interesting. Normally, the way we kind of run our business is more of in, like, one jean in, one jean out, like, smaller production runs, keeping things really tight as far as inventory. To, like, get influxes of a lot of stuff, the 2 to 3 times a year is always exciting.
Yeah, so when you put something on the lineup, it tends to stick around for a while.
I always test. That's my way of testing. I call it a collection, but it's also, like, kind of putting my ideas out there to see how they respond and react to that. So if something, for instance, is like the ISC work shirt, I've done iterations of that since 2009, and I know it's just a staple piece for us, but I always want to introduce it now that like people kind of expect a quote unquote collection from us. I like to introduce a new fabric and maybe a new style, or in the, like, the traditional work shirt style, see how it does throughout the season. And if it's one of those things people keep asking for, stores keep coming back for, I usually roll it into something that will be around for a lot longer, a staple piece, which I like. I don't consider what we do as fashion. I try to, like, play the line of introducing and playing with new fabrics and new styles, but everything here is seasonless. Everything here is essentially
It's like atemporal, almost.
Kind of, yeah.
You could wear it any time between, like, 1945 and, you know, today, and nobody would really, like, you wouldn't stick out too much.
Well, thank you. That's kind of the intent. So, if things work, why dump them? So,
exactly.
So that's kind of just how we've been able to grow.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, take me back to the beginning of the brand and how those ideas first started out. And
okay.
I guess when Carl Thonesson first became involved in denim. So I remember we talked about this a few years ago, and
sure.
you were going into like your first exposure to Evisus, I think, back in the early 2000s, and
yep.
then apprenticing and
right.
Yeah.
Well, so what brought me to Los Angeles was my girlfriend, who is now my wife, Leslie Young. She
Little Pellets.
If you're
on Instagram.
That's right. she wanted to change career. She was in biotech, and at this time, I was in San Diego, and I was just kind of like, I was wearing like 501 1947s when they were released back then, and that was 2006.
Yeah. And they were still made in the Valencia Street factory, and it
probably.
Was, yeah.
Yeah, a while back, my coworkers all thought I was crazy. But even before that, like you said, Evisu and who else? Oh, Lee. I was wearing 101 Zs that I got in Amsterdam. So I was in it. I was passionate about it from a consumer aspect. Leslie decided to change career. She got into business school up here in LA. So I was like, oh, I'll go to LA. I'm kind of done with San Diego. Let's see what LA has to offer. No desire other than an interest in fashion. No desire to be in
fashion.
Just
sort of an enthusiast at the time.
Yeah.
Like, what was it like being a denim head in like the mid 2000s? Because there weren't things like Super Future was just sort of in its nascent stage.
Sure.
There weren't a lot of places to like find the information online, and you sort of like really had to hunt it down.
You learned.
Yeah.
I washed my 101 Zs and they look like crap. And I was like, no, no, what did I do wrong?
And then, to go back to Amsterdam.
Yeah. So it was one of those, okay, well, I'm never going to wash my jeans again.
Yeah.
It was just because they went from, because I was skating in them, skateboarding.
Mm-hmm.
So they were getting sweaty and I washed them what I thought was the right way. And they wound up getting thrown into the dryer by my roommate. And they turned out like this hideous blue color that I would never wear. So after that, I was kind of like just figuring it out, I guess. There weren't really forums. It was kind of word of mouth, I guess. You would just kind of happen upon people in circles that are like, oh yeah, salvage denim, that's cool. Like, I have a pair of such and such jeans that I came across, and it was always a story at that time.
Yeah.
It was like,
and then you compare notes and figure out, like, you know,
right.
look at each other's fades.
Mm-hmm.
And you're sort of part of it was like a club like atmosphere back then.
It still is to a certain extent now. I mean, it's larger for sure, but there's still so many people that are learning about it for the first time, which is awesome. I remember Jean Shop just opening their one store in Soho, and that was my first kind of introduction to Japanese salvage denim in the U.S., made in the U.S. It was rad. I was like, I remember walking into their store, seeing the little, they have like little jeans there, the like one 100th size jeans, and all their like leather shirts and there was something there. There was something cool there that, like, it was a start of American culture kind of picking up where it left off in the 50s and 60s. And so, I was really excited to kind of find them and research more about what was coming out. I remember buying a pair of their jeans and probably wearing them. I probably wore them for a year. And then tried to alter them myself, and I destroyed them.
Oh.
But
you got to do that a few times before you can get it right.
Yeah, yeah. But other than that, once I moved up to Los Angeles, I didn't have a job. I quit my job And I fortunately had enough money saved to be like, okay, I need to figure out what I'm going to do up here. It's definitely going to be something different than what I was doing in San Diego. And I happened upon Brian Kim, who had Work Custom Jeans. And and I kind of just hounded him, basically just asked him every question that any person that was passionate about denim and seeing someone making it with their hands would want to ask someone like that. Yeah. But I didn't know anything about sewing. I didn't know anything about pattern making at the time. This was 2007. And I convinced him to take me on as an apprentice. But it was interesting because his approach was, look, I'm a one-man operation. I'm doing all this myself. I don't have time to babysit you. Mm-hmm. So you're welcome to show up when the doors are open and leave when I'm locking up. But kind of like,
don't get in my way.
But he's obviously, he was super nice and, mm-hmm. and respectful, and as I was. And so I just started picking up a broom every day and trying to just like clean up where he would leave off. And then he just said, hey, jump on a machine, get to feel the pedal, get to like, you know, mm-hmm. be comfortable sewing denim. And then from there, he realized I wasn't going away, so
might as well train him.
He basically just said, take a pattern off the wall, take a pair of take some denim and cut them out and try and sew a pair of jeans. Mm-hmm. You've seen me do different aspects of this, so just do it, just figure it out. I don't have time to teach you, but if you really get stuck, I'll point you in the right direction. Which like for me, it was exciting because it was a problem to be solved. And at the mm-hmm. same, and it's like the best way, if you're going to be learning anything, that's the best way to do it.
Yeah.
It's like, get in there, get stuck, sit on it, think about it, figure it out. And then that pair of jeans was made.
Yeah. I was just going to ask, is that the one up there?
Yeah.
I'll take a picture of them, put them up when we post the episode that they're,
yeah, it's the first pair of jeans.
They look a lot better than the pair of jeans that I could make at the moment. They look like jeans. They look like they fit. You know, you've got selvage belt loops on there. You've got your little loop stitch on the back pocket is still in place.
Yep.
Yeah, and it's like you have hidden rivets in there, too.
Hidden rivets. Yeah. So at that time...
you even have a flat-felled inseam... It's overlocked.
Those are both flat-felled. The yoke and the center seam in the back are flat-felled.
Yeah.
Single needle waistband.
7 belt loops, like a pair of Wranglers. It's
sure. Yep. Yeah. So like
are decent.
Thanks. For me, I definitely wasn't thinking about anything more than I want to make a pair of jeans, mm-hmm. and selvage for me was like the kind of pinnacle of premium denim. So mm-hmm. I was like, I gotta show it everywhere. So I have a little tab up there. I have belt loops. Uh-huh. And then I was like loving Repro and loving my 501s. So I was like, all right, I gotta figure out how to do hidden rivets. So the lasso stitch, the little loop up there, was actually a mistake because if you see, it's like a 1/8 inch and then a 1/4 inch stitch all the way up. And then I forgot that I needed to like give myself room to get around the rivet. So I just started going, and I wound up just going into a loop. And when I was wearing these, people kept commenting
on the loop,
and they're saying, "Oh, what kind of jeans are those? I've never seen that detail before." So many years later, many iterations later, I was like, "I got to figure out how to tie that into
your production chain."
Yeah, what we do now, but the. From there, the intent was never to start a denim brand. Yeah. I was just kind of figuring things out as I went along, and it wound up that a position needed to be filled at American Rag. They were looking for a full-time denim tailor.
Mm-hmm. American Rag is like the biggest denim store, like in this Los side Angeles. Of the Mississippi, basically.
Yeah, squirrel. So they were looking for an in-house denim tailor. Brian Kim had something set up there, but he was having a hard time finding someone to fill that space. So when it came time to move on, he wound up having to close his workshop. I just went to them and said, hey, I know you need someone here, but instead of us doing the transactions through your terminal, mm-hmm. at your cashier, why don't we just treat it as a separate business?
Yeah.
So I'll take full responsibility for all the alterations, returns, questions, and payment. So I'll bring my own credit card processing system in. And they said, great, fine. We didn't want to deal with it anyway. So that was the start of Rogue Territory. It was basically a 10 by 10 space where I
sewed custom jeans to American Rag customers, basically.
This is, yeah. So
that's a nice way to start under the radar there, to like sort of get yourself inculcated in a really, really popular denim spot.
Kind of gives you intimate or immediate legitimacy.
Yeah.
When you start saying, oh, I make jeans and I'm an American Rag. So that was huge. And again, like it wasn't like this was a business plan. It just kind of happened. And I knew that after making 3 pairs of jeans before I had to leave and go to American Rag, I knew there was something there that spoke to me other than, oh, it's cool to make jeans. Like I wanted to figure out if there was a way to make a business out of it or at least pay my bills.
Yeah.
So I started there, and funny enough, my first customer was the most amazing customer. It was a woman. She was in her mid to late 50s, and she was super curvy, and she wanted everything I couldn't do. She wanted like welt pockets, a three inch waistband with darts in the back, and like super like welt pockets in the front, like everything that you. I was like, I don't know how to do any of this stuff, but I made it seem like I
will learn. Yeah. How many pairs did it take before you gave her one?
And she wanted 100% cotton, no stretch, but she wanted them fitted. And I was like, shoot me in the head right now. But Brian, fortunately, he was there. He had another workshop where he was with a friend, and he kind of just helped me figure out these little nuances, and then I'd go back to her. It wound up being, I think, 3 fittings, and she was super patient and excited about it. And they wound up looking great at the end, but I just got thrown into it, and it was fun.
Yeah.
And I was there for 2.5 years.
What was the weirdest pair of jeans you made, I guess, besides that first one? Like, you
have those any, are probably the weirdest.
Any odd requests that come through the door? Like, oh, okay, I guess we're sewing that today.
Yes. Okay. So, LA being LA, it attracts money from all over the world. I made 8 pairs of jeans for 2 Saudi princes.
Wow.
And they were 8 and 10 years old. And
did you make, you know, 8 pairs of jeans, like one for like as they grew up so they could continue wearing these jeans?
No. So they have so much money that basically they said, I want every pair of jeans to be completely different. They need to, and these kids were the most oddly shaped kids I've ever seen, and they were super, super rotund. And they needed to fit like right under their nipples. Like super high waisted,
really?
So I had to add elastic to all the waistbands, and every pair of jeans needed to look different, but they wanted them to look kind of like True Religion, because at that time True Religion was huge, and they wanted that,
like the huge stitches and the big embellishments in the back pocket. Yeah. And the...
So I had to make essentially.
Because these kids probably couldn't fit into True Religion, so you had to make True Religion.
Well, they were getting custom Dolce & Gabbana, Versace, like everything. Every high-end label, they were getting custom.
Wow.
So, yeah, their assistant found me, and he just said, you know, we'll pay you cash, but they all have to be different. And, like, that was the most insane process ever. I just remember at the end of it, I was sitting next to someone from Chanel, and they were waiting to get paid, and I just saw, like, stacks of cash just, like, change hands. I was like,
you come with jeans and leave with a briefcase.
Yeah. I was scared to leave the hotel because like I had all this cash in my pocket. I was like, this is weird.
Yeah.
But they were super nice. They were telling me about their zoo. They asked me how many animals I had. I said 1. They're like, only 1 dog? Okay.
Uh-huh.
So it was a really interesting experience. And then from there, I did some stuff for some celebrities, which was interesting. But yeah, so I just kind of went along. And then one day Jennifer, who was the denim buyer at the time, said, have you ever thought about putting jeans on the shelf here?
Mm-hmm.
I said, I honestly haven't had enough time to think about that. I would make jeans for myself. I'd make jeans for Leslie, some for my brother, but I never really thought, okay, well, like, what would Rogue Territory look like if to a consumer as they were shopping? So when she asked me that, I was like, yeah, I think that would be really cool. So I did an SK, I did a Dean, which is now the Stanton, and I did a standard issue fit, which standard issue was my version of the 501 1947. Yeah. And then I did the work shirt, the work trouser, and that was it. And oh, it was so like it was 20 pieces of each.
Yeah, so you didn't just launch with one jean, you had a, you know, a collection, basically.
Yeah, and they like carved out a little corner for me in the store and put a mannequin in there, and I got to merchandise it the way I wanted, and and they started selling, which was like crazy for me. I was like, whoa, people are buying these. This is really cool. And I love the whole process of like figuring out, instead of making one jean, I'm making 20. What does that production process look like? How do I get that done?
Yeah, and so, this was at American Rag too, where they could, you know, they were right next to Nudies and like Naked and Famous and LBC RRL. And Double RL. So, you know, like it must have made you feel pretty good to see them like be bought with all that other like really, really great denim sitting around them.
Yeah. Yeah. It was a really exciting time. It totally kind of like opened my eyes to a different path in a way. Cause I love the production process. I love figuring that out. I loved taking a concept and duplicating it and seeing what that looks like and kind of figuring out new problems and solving those new problems. So then, of course, seeing them sold, which was super weird and like gratifying at the same time. And it was a different feeling than a custom customer being like, these are my favorite jeans ever, because I was like, well, duh, it took me 12 hours to make those. So it was like, to hear someone say, oh, I love these jeans, and I'm like, oh, well, that fit, that, like, pattern must be pretty good. That's different. Like, it's a different feeling, because...
Were you still sewing everything yourself for this
one? No, that was the thing. It was the moment Jennifer asked me to do this, I had a friend who was producing his line downtown, Matias Sandoval, and he was like, integral in, like, essentially being like, no, you're not going to do this yourself. We need to go downtown. I have a sewer myself, so I'll help you. And he kind of walked me through what a production process would look like. Mm-hmm. And then I kind of took it and ran with it. And the funny thing is, like, the jeans that I made then, they had the lasso stitch in them, but they look so different to what our jeans look like now that I tell people that it took 3 years for me to be happy with the jeans coming off of the production
line. Yeah, because getting your vision sort of translated into somebody else sewing it, that's hard.
It's hard, but it's also rewarding in a way, because, I mean, the manufacturer, we still work with them. It's 6 sewers, family owned, and every one of those sewers has been there since I started.
Oh.
And I sat down with every one of them saying, no, I really want 12 stitches per inch. I don't want 9. And they're like, why? I'm like, well, first of all, aesthetically, I like the way it looks, but it also serves a functional purpose.
Tensile strength increased there, so it's just all these little details. Because there's just so much you can build into a pair of jeans that, you know, you don't see it at all.
Right, exactly.
But
to the novice, you know, to a new customer, they wouldn't think about it until they start actually learning more about that.
But
process.
Stitches per inch like that, you can go anywhere from like, you know, 5 to 15, and it completely changes the jean.
Right, but it slows down the production process.
Oh, yeah. It
increases the cost and all those things.
Literally 3 times slower if you go from one to the other there.
Yeah, so all that stuff was really fun to me, and a completely new world and a new direction. So it kind of just started from there, and it was like, okay, people like the work trousers, people like the work shirt. Let's introduce new fabrics and new colors. And I was finding that the standard issue was attracting an older customer, which was awesome. But at the same time, I was like, I don't want to confuse who I'm going after. And it's not an old customer. Like the old customer just liked the higher waist, looser thigh, tapered look. And I was like, no, I need someone that's like, their early 20s, mid 20s, or even early 30s, that someone that wants like a more just a better, like a nicer fitting silhouette, so
higher quality jean than what they were previously exposed to.
Right, so I cut that standard issue after probably a year. But then especially with like being so small and self-funded, I just having so many more SKUs that mm-hmm. like you could see the standard issue just wasn't moving as fast. I just decided that it wasn't worthwhile to have so much to offer and just dial it back and present what I know is performing. So mm-hmm. that's kind of how I did. And it still translates now to how I kind of position mm-hmm. everything we do.
Are you guys still self-funded? Mm-hmm. Wow. Congratulations. Yeah.
That's something we're really proud of, is every production run and every jean we sell pays for the next pair of jeans that we sell. So yeah. It's all self-funded. It's just, it's three of us, me, Preston, and Leslie.
Yeah. And you can get yourself out on a big limb if you take investment.
Yeah. And that was the thing, is like, I'm not interested. Like, all of this is kind of just organic. And not intentionally organic. It's, I don't want to feel that I owe someone anything, and I don't want someone telling me what I should be doing or should not be doing. Because at the end of the day, I don't know what I'm doing.
Yeah.
So I'd rather me figure it out than someone else tell me that I should be doing this. So, and I've found that, like, if I listen to too many people telling me what I should do, I waste a lot of money and a lot of time. Like, mm-hmm. I did a jean called the Steve back mm-hmm. in the day, like 3 years ago, which was my attempt to get a lower price point Rogue Territory jean in mm-hmm. stores. And the way it was lower price point was I took off the lasso stitch, I took off like a bunch of like, I standardized a lot of the sewing.
Mm-hmm.
I took off like screen printed pocket bags, I took the labels off, I took the branded rivets off.
Just everything that made it a Rogue Territory jean sort of fell off of it.
Exactly. And I mean, simplified the back pocket. Just wanted like my version of a unbranded jean. Mm-hmm. Essentially, and nobody bought it. Mm. And I went deep. I like made a lot of those before anybody like saw it. I was like, no. Like I'm hearing from all these buyers from stores saying they need this. This is the price point, 150 to 165. We need American made jeans in this price point because that's where APC was.
Yeah.
APC originally was 155.
Mm-hmm.
And they were like, we need an American made jean to compete with APC. So I was like, all right, done. 300 jeans later, nobody bought them.
No, we don't need that.
like all of our customers. And it's funny because I get customers now saying, I love the Steves. Like I bought them on super, super, super sale.
Mm-hmm.
but they're my favorite pair of jeans. I'm like, fuck you. at the time, it was one of those things where I just listened to someone but most of our customers said, no, we want all of those details because that's what makes your jean unique mm-hmm. and we are willing to pay for them, which was like, oh, all right, cool.
Yeah.
That's it.
That makes sense. Yeah.
All right. Let's do that. Let's keep doing that.
mm-hmm. But you've got to, I guess, make mistakes like that to really appreciate your customer and know that you're headed in the right direction.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's
definitely... you know that what the dead ends are out there. You don't know that where those roads might lead.
Yeah. Yeah. It's all of it. I mean, we're still learning all the time, and that's the best thing about having a small team, doing everything ourselves, and being self-funded, is that we can literally figure out what we want to do and turn on a dime to do that.
Oh, like, you know, move downtown or fill your house full of denim or...
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
But it's been, you know, slow and steady growth for you guys pretty much since the beginning, that, you know, more stockists, more countries, more jeans going out is, and it just like I've seen your name in more and more places, each and every year. Oh, is that, I guess the continued plan is just slow organic growth and just see where it goes, or?
Yeah.
Is there any like ultimate end game you have in your mind right now?
No, the end game is nowhere in sight, really. We don't know what that, I mean, sure. Like people, Leslie going to business school, I always got the question when I'd be out with drinks with some of her friends. So, you know, what are you doing in to get bought? Or like, what are you looking to do to get acquired?
Yeah.
And I'm like, why would I, like, what's the point of that? Like, this business is not cookie cutter. It's not, there's no, like, I couldn't sell this to someone and have them succeed with the same brand.
No, you'd have to sell yourself to them in order for it to.
Yeah, and I'm not doing that. Like, I'm not working for anybody again. knock on wood. But yeah, that was always my thing. It was like, no, I didn't start this brand because I had an end game. It just kind of happened, and it was because I didn't feel like I had anything to prove. It was me, and like, this is kind of how we just describe Rogue Territory now, is it's exploration. Like, that's what Rogue Territory means to me, is that I'm constantly figuring things out and looking for new stuff, playing with new fabrics, but like keeping the core the same, which is it better be made well and the fabric better speak for itself. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of it.
Yeah.
Like, I don't have a vision necessarily. I just produce what I like. Mm-hmm. And hopefully other people like it. And as far as expansion is concerned, we work with stores that are interested in a long-term relationship. We're not interested in opening more e-commerce stores. We're not interested in being in 5 doors in one city, Los Angeles excluded. We're not interested in being everywhere. And we're not interested in competing on price, because that's not what our brand is about.
Yeah.
So...
That's sort of the ideology behind the RGT fam that you guys have been building up, like, just... Yeah. Having sort of lifelong customers, and like, you know, stockists as well, is you go to places like, you know, Snake Oil Provisions or Berkeley Supply or Dutille.
Mm-hmm.
It's, you know, they're devoted.
Yeah, yeah. And that's,
you guys are devoted to them, and it seems like a great relationship that's...
Right.
And, you know, they even have their like, you know, subgroupies that buy Rogue Territory stuff in their respective cities.
Yeah.
Just because, like, oh, you know, the division has been communicated pretty well.
I guess. I mean, again, it wasn't anything that was written down on paper, and like, that was our goal for 2013.
Mm-hmm.
and we don't have sales goals.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't have any expectations. So it's like...
Very zen there.
I don't know. Yeah. And I think that's what people respond to. Because the moment you start getting competitive, and the moment you start saying you're doing something better than someone else, it puts you in a completely different ball game. And sure, I'm competitive, but I don't necessarily think that translates well when you start talking about it. It's like, yeah, like, I would love to do something that nobody else is doing. I wanna find that fabric that nobody else has seen. I wanna introduce a style that makes people do a double take. But that's my competitive set, like how much I sold per year, what stores I'm in, or because once you start doing that, then that's what defines your brand for me anyway.
You're personally a number and not a product anymore.
So it's interesting, you know. It's on the production side and kind of how we present our brand and how we have grown. It's interesting to kind of balance all these things, but it also comes very naturally. So it's not the moment we start feeling like something is being forced, like we went to Bread and Butter, we felt like that was forced.
Mm-hmm.
So we decided not to do it again. And the reason we went to Bread and Butter was because people told us we needed a larger presence in the European market.
Yeah.
And we were like, why?
Yeah, for those listeners, Bread and Butter is like, it was the super big trade show in Berlin every season that brought out like all the European buyers together for, you know, denim and other vintage inspired stuff.
Right.
Yeah.
So it was great to be there and to experience it. It's an amazing show. It's like the Tempelhof building is just beautiful. But we just found that the right stores will find us.
Mm-hmm.
And if it's, we open one new store in Europe, which is what we did last year with Cultism, that's enough for us.
Yeah.
Because they will be a better brand champion than 10 stores that opened us just because they found us online.
Yeah, the intent was so much greater there.
Yeah. Like Bakery at Cultism was excited about what we are doing.
And they have a lot of awesome denim there as well. Like, they carry, like, a lot of the really great European brands and some Japanese ones too. So it's, is that, Was that your first European account?
No, Tanitanin was.
Oh, Tanitanin, yeah.
Yeah, they've been brand champions for a long time.
Yeah, so you had those cool collabs with them a couple of years back.
Yeah, yeah, they're awesome guys. And they, like, yeah, they've kind of built a cult following of Rogue Territory fans in Amsterdam and beyond. Like, a lot of people travel through Amsterdam, so it's a really cool kind of cross-section of people that are picking up Rogue Territory.
Yeah. Yeah, I met a guy at Denim by PV in May who was like from Mallorca, Spain, that has his own like denim jacket brand that he was wearing a pair of the Tenue de Nimes collabs.
The Broken Twill.
Yeah, the Broken Twills is like, that's how I got to talking to him. I was like, hey, where'd you get those? Like, we're on the same level here as it was just, you know, all those Abercrombie and Target buyers.
That's
and,
cool. Yeah, that's right.
See, we're at the same party here.
Yeah, people keep asking me to bring those back, so.
Yeah, it was a cool jean.
Yeah, it was fun. That basically what inspired that. So I, that was a closeout cone fabric. Mm-hmm. I didn't buy that directly from Cone. And I was inspired by the Broken Twill vintage Wrangler color of those. So I was like, okay, well, why don't I take the fabric and let it speak for itself, do tonal stitching. But all the details on that were essentially a harken back to a Wrangler jean. So the yoke was reversed. The yoke was on top of the back panel. The coin pocket was across the pocket facing instead of its own kind of standalone 501 style coin pocket. Just like little, it had the flat felt seam, inseam and side seam. So I was just like kind of inspired by that fabric, and it wound up translating really well. People seem to like it, so that was a fun project.
Yeah, it's neat to do those kind of one-offs. Do you have any other one of those coming up soon that you can you can leak out? That Nifty Do one was amazing.
Thank you. Yeah, that was fun.
I've had a lot of people email me about those. They're just like, they sold out. Like, where can I get one? I'm like, sorry, dude, you can't.
So that's kind of, that also, the whole special projects thing for me is really just my interest and my, like, short, what's the word?
Attention span.
Yeah, short attention span on things. Because, like, I'll find a fabric and I will want to make something right away.
Mm-hmm.
Like these Sashiko
fabrics. Yeah, I was admiring these over here. Like, these are new.
Yeah, so those are from Neon Mempu too, but it's always that way where it's like, okay, well, I could wait and put this in a collection, or I could just make something.
Do it right now because I want it out, and like, yeah. I want it at the moment.
Right, so when I was talking with Don Lee over at Nifty Do, he was like, they're a huge supporter of ours in Vancouver, and we were just kind of chatting about something special, and they were like, well, the Stealth Supply Jacket does really well for us. How about doing something with leather? And I like cringed. Because leather is not fun to work with, and there's so much waste. So I was like, I don't know, I'll think about it. And as I was like looking at some of the leather that I used on a campus jacket we did the previous season, I was like, man, it kind of looks really good with our Stealth denim. So called him up, and I was like, all right, let's do this. Let's do the Stealth with a leather sleeve. I'll finish the details a little bit differently, and it just worked out really well. And it's just fun to, like, see the excitement around those. Like, I was actually walking out of Inspiration, and a good customer of ours was walking in, and he was wearing it.
I saw that guy wearing them.
I was like, I ran back, and I was like, nice jacket, dude. Good for you for getting that. That was awesome.
Yeah.
So.
That must be so surreal, seeing people, like, out in the wild wearing your stuff.
It is. I mean, because I never really approached Rogue Territory as a... Like, I never thought of myself as a designer. So, like, for people to, like, see me as a designer and then also be so excited about what I'm doing is, like, the whole thing is just kind of always, I'm playing kind of, like, catch up and being like, whoa, that's really cool. Like, I don't think of myself as, like, putting myself out there. So, for, like, people to respond that way is, like, it's exciting.
Cool. Where do you think denim, I guess, in general is heading? Because it's sort of seen a huge upswell in the past few years that everyone is much more aware of raw denim and selvedge denim and sort of what it has to offer. That, and you know, we've seen it on our readership has gone way up, and I guess like a lot of brands like yourself have been able to expand quite a bit. Mm-hmm. Is that, do you just see that the gravy train keep rolling there, or is it something
the gravy
that...
gravy train. It's interesting. Yeah, there's definitely, I kind of consider it selvedge overkill.
Yeah.
But, to a certain extent, I think that there will be a balancing of the scales a little bit, and people will, I mean, it's already happening. Customers are so much more discerning because of websites like yours. They get a lot more education before they can make a purchase. So they're you can see them obviously balancing their options and like kind of what team they want to go with. You know, that I don't see that as a bad thing. I see that as a good thing.
Yeah, the more educated the customer, the better, because they know exactly what they're getting, and they're never going to be disappointed, really.
Right, and it challenges us. It challenges us to keep innovating, to make our stuff better, because there's some stuff where you, like, I'll definitely get bummed out when someone is misinformed about something and comes at it from a place of, like, I just gave you $200 for a pair of jeans that are supposed to last me a lifetime.
And I spent, doing construction for, 2 years and they don't hold up. Like, what's the deal?
And then they try to tie that to, the Made in America movement is kind of bullshit.
Mm-hmm.
They've, bought into something that they felt like they were conned into because, Made in America is supposed to be better. Yeah. I'm like, well, not necessarily, dude. It takes a lot for any manufacturing of any kind to be good.
Mm-hmm.
So just because it's made in America doesn't necessarily mean that it's the best. Like, we have to strive every day to make a great quality product. It's just not expected. It can't just be expected. So, yeah, we're going to make mistakes. So sometimes shit happens. But what winds up happening is we have to be there to stand behind every product that we make and to believe in what we're doing and also to take care of our customers. And that is what's really important to us, is that customers feel like they can be completely honest and open with us and that we're not going to just slam the door in their face.
Yeah, because I think there is kind of a misnomer on Made in America that it somehow just immediately means high quality and good, because you're like, I could make a pair of jeans tomorrow. They would be made in America. They wouldn't be good. They might be okay. I don't know. They wouldn't be good. Like, people wouldn't buy them. But where your production is, what does Made in America mean to you? Like, has that been something that you're definitely committed to for the future lifespan of Rogue Territory?
I couldn't imagine doing what we're doing in any other capacity than Made in America, made in my backyard. Because I'm so OCD about everything that we do, that I better be able to, on a drop of a dime, drive down or go next door to wherever my stuff is being made and say, yo guys, this is wrong, let's fix it before we get even wronger.
So, it's even more specific to you. It's made in Los Angeles, because I'm in Los Angeles, because if you had your production here and you were in Cincinnati or something, it'd be just as difficult.
You might
for
as
you.
Well be in Vietnam or China or because it's there's so much. If there's room for error will occur, and there's always room for error in production. So the only way you're gonna get exactly what you want is to be present. So it's we're for me, I'm really proud that I've been able to work with the same manufacturer for 6 years. We have a relationship that you're not gonna get anywhere else. They know our product inside and out now. That I couldn't imagine, even though we're scaling, they're scaling with us. And both of us are very cognizant and aware of kind of what we both bring to the table. And hopefully, we can continue to have that relationship. So it's been really exciting kind of seeing the progression on that side of the business, and how we've been able to work together. So, but I mean, as far as the kind of the landscape, the denim landscape as it is, for me, I would be excited if I had, if I were able to play with other fabrics besides selvage. Mm-hmm. I love selvage. Selvage is it like selvage. The selvage detail in itself is beautiful. The selvage fabric is, for the most part, premium. You're not getting better quality than that. But like, my relationship with Neon Mempu, they have so many beautiful wide good fabrics that I would love for people to accept a jean that was not necessarily selvage, because they have so much more to offer. Their their catalog is huge. Selvage is kind of limiting.
I got to see all their swatches. It was just nuts, everything that they have there, that they can do really anything you can imagine.
Yeah.
The fabric. Yeah. But if you release a jean today with like an overlock stitch and like, you know, a raw jean that's over $200, you're going to get blasted for it.
Right. Which I wouldn't do. But yeah. if I were going to do that, it would probably be like a flat felled seam on the side, or like incorporate the story. Like, I would tell the story a little bit differently. I wouldn't just do a Stanton with an overlock stitch on it. I have done that in the past, and I've
That split selvage one.
The split selvage.
That one was really cool.
Yeah, it did well, but it was definitely, we got a lot of comments like,
where's the other half, bro?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Are you taking shortcuts?
Yeah.
I wasn't mad at that. I didn't, I was a little surprised, but at the same time, I was like, well, I mean, it's a great opportunity to educate people, and it wasn't super risky on our part. So, and the fabric spoke for itself. So we wound up selling all of them. It just took a little longer.
Good to hear.
Yeah.
Cool. Well, anything else you wanted to get into while we're here? I think I covered all my points that I wanted to.
Okay.
Peg you on, and we're. Yeah, you thought we couldn't fill an hour, and here we are, Carl.
Well, no. Unless you have any questions about. You asked about new stuff coming out.
Yeah. This might be staggered like a month or two, so.
Yeah. Sure. We have, I'm personally releasing, just on our website, a new fit called the Strider, which is essentially a harken back to my standard issue. So it's essentially my take on a 1947 501.
Oh, so the standard issue's coming back?
Yeah, but in the form of the Strider, and that... The name was inspired by
Lord of the Rings.
Yes. Yes.
That's what I was hoping when I heard that.
Aragorn, before he was, when he was a ranger from the north.
Yeah.
So basically it'll have hidden rivets. It'll have a little bit higher rise, fuller upper thigh, tapered fit. The first denim we're doing out of is right there. Actually, it's a 48% hemp, 52% cotton from Neon Mempu.
Nice and hairy. Yeah, I remember this one. Yeah. Is it unsamferized?
No, it's samferized. It's fully, like... It's
just super slubby.
Yeah, super slubby, like super irregular weave construction. Actually, really loose tension weave construction.
It's
so,
what, like 15, 16 ounces?
It's 14 and a half, they say.
Be a good summer jean.
But the thing is, like, the fabric breathes really well since it is a looser weave construction, but the tensile strength on the hemp is insane. Like, it's bulletproof.
Really?
Like, I pulled it apart while I was in the meeting with them and trying to, like, because normally if you get like the weft out of a pair of jeans,
yeah, then you can snap it pretty easily.
You can snap it pretty. This I like wound around my finger and was trying to rip and break, and it wasn't breaking, so pretty excited about that.
Hemp's good for a lot of things.
It is, yeah. So that's kind of like Neon Mempu's, like, this is our green production. This is like a green fabric for us, pure indigo dyed, and the hemp. So excited. I'm just breaking that pairing, so I'm excited to get that out in the next 2 months.
2 months? I think we'll look forward to them.
Yeah.
Cool.
Well,
thanks so much for having me over and taking the time, Carl. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, it's been fun.
Cool. We'll talk again soon.
Definitely.
This episode of the Rar Denim Podcast is brought to you by North American Quality Purveyors. Their mission is as clear as their name. North American Quality Purveyors brings together Canadian and American-made men's apparel and accessories from brands devoted to creating quality, crafted products that will stand the test of time. Both online and in their store in Calgary, NAQP carries a curated selection of the best North American products from Railcar Fine Goods, Gitman Brothers Vintage, Left Field NYC, New England Outerwear, Victory, Telesyn, DN1920, and of course, Rogue Territory. NAQP is offering podcast listeners 15% off their order with the discount code RAR15. That's RAWR15 for 15% off all regularly priced items. Buy quality, buy North American Quality Purveyors. All right, so big thanks to Carl for coming on and sharing his insights into what it took to start Rogue Territory. We'll be back again soon with more interviews from your favorite people in the denim and non-denim industry. So if you have any questions, please send them to info@rardenim.com. And if you enjoyed this podcast, please help support our sponsor, North American Quality Purveyors, by visiting their website, which is www.shopnorthamerican.com, and using the code RAR15 for 15% off all regularly priced items at checkout. So thanks again for listening, and we'll talk again soon.